Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, President Obama has envisioned a future without nuclear weapons. But what has he done to make that a reality? There are currently 15,000 active nuclear warheads around the world, and the U.S. has plans to spend $1 trillion over the next 30 years on a renewed stockpile. Dr. Ira Helfand calls for a great debate over plans to modernize our arsenal. He calls it an existential threat to human survival. Dr. Helfand is a co-president of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War and a co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He practices medicine in Massachusetts. In this excerpt, we're presenting the core of Helfand's talk at Town Hall Seattle on March 20th. You can hear the full program, including questions and answers, on our website, KUOW.org/speakersforum. Thank you to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording.
I want to talk to you tonight about nuclear war. This is not an easy thing to talk about or for you to listen to, and I very much appreciate your coming out on a Sunday evening to hear what I have to say. There was a time just a few decades ago when all of us understood the danger posed by nuclear weapons. Millions of people around the world were actively engaged in a campaign to eliminate these weapons and to prevent nuclear war. And the reality of nuclear weaponry, the danger posed to human survival, was deeply understood by all of these people and by many millions more who weren't active. That period of activity, of activism, was enormously important. It led to real changes in public policy. It put enormous pressure on the governments of the Soviet Union and the United States and played a critical role in changing the nuclear policies that were in place at that time. I think a lot of us who were active then worried at times that we were being alarmist, that we were unnecessarily burdening people with fears about how dangerous nuclear weapons were. It turns out that we weren't, that the things that we said then were not only true, but we probably, despite our efforts to get it right, were underestimating the full magnitude of the danger. And it turns out that the work that we did then in motivating people to pressure their governments was critically important. In his memoirs, Mikhail Gorbachev specifically references the work done by physicians and the meetings that he had with members of IPPNW in fundamentally changing his understanding of the danger posed by nuclear weapons and leading him to undertake the series of initiatives which he launched in the mid-1980s, which the United States eventually joined and which led to the end of the Cold War arms race and helped to bring about the end of the Cold War itself. This is an immense achievement of citizen activism and one which we urgently need to recreate today. Because the problem is that when the Cold War ended, we, all of us, began to act as though these weapons had gone away. They should have. They were built for the most part to fight the Cold War, and when the Cold War ended, any rationale for their existence ended at that point. But the weapons didn't go away. And in fact, there are today about 15,000 nuclear warheads in the world. About 95% are in the arsenals of the United States and Russia. The rest are shared by seven other nuclear weapon states, the United Kingdom, France, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. And these weapons continue to pose really an existential threat to human survival. There are three dimensions of the nuclear threat that I want to talk to you about tonight, and let me go through them each sequentially. First is the possibility, the problem that we face, that there might be an act of nuclear terrorism. To the extent that people talk about nuclear weapons at all, this is what they tend to focus on. And there's some reason for that. This is a real serious problem. We know that terrorist groups, specifically Al-Qaeda, have been trying for at least 25 years to obtain nuclear materials. We know that there are fully assembled nuclear weapons in the arsenals of Pakistan and probably still in Russia that are not optimally guarded and are potentially subject to theft. And we know that there are about 2,000 tons of fissile material, plutonium and highly enriched uranium, stored in more than 40 countries around the world, much of it with very little security. And it only takes a few pounds of either one of these materials to make a nuclear weapon. That's the hard part, getting the plutonium or the highly enriched uranium. Once you have that, it's relatively easy to make a crude nuclear device. You can go online and read directions on how to do this. And so there was a real concern that terrorists might obtain either a weapon or the fissile material to build their own and use this. And the effects of this would be quite catastrophic. There have been a number of studies about this. The paper that I published in the British Medical Journal in 2002, shortly after September 11th, looked at a scenario where a terrorist group built a crude bomb about the size of the Hiroshima bomb and basically mailed it to the United States, put it on a cargo ship, and programmed it to detonate as it approached the pier in Manhattan. Under this scenario, much of the explosive force is dissipated over the water in New York Harbor. But even so, this explosion kills about 44,000 people outright from the blast and the fire. And another 10,000 people are exposed to lethal doses of radiation emanating from the bomb at the moment of detonation. In addition, about 1.5 million people are exposed to significant levels of radioactive fallout. This is a ground-level burst. It generates a great deal of local fallout, and it's carried by prevailing westerly winds over Manhattan, Queens, Brooklyn, Long Island, very densely populated areas. About 1.5 million people get exposed, and of these, about 250,000 people receive lethal doses of radiation if they are not promptly evacuated or sheltered. And the fact is that neither New York nor any other city in the United States has in place a plan to evacuate or shelter in place any significant number of people. And so the death toll from this terrorist attack on New York would probably be in the range of about 300,000 people. And to put that into perspective, during all of World War II, about 440,000 Americans were killed. And that was over the 4 years of the war. This would be in about a week's time. The economic disruption caused by this is literally incalculable. There was a study done about 15 years ago looking at a similar scenario that assumed that the economic damage would be in the range of $1 trillion. In that scenario, the bomb went off in New York Harbor, but not in Manhattan, across the river on the New Jersey side of the harbor. I think that that study was a tremendous underestimate of what would happen. For one thing, if bomb went off in Manhattan, we're talking about some of the most valuable real estate in the world. But even more important than the destruction of property in Manhattan is the effect on the global economy. I mean, Wall Street would be shut down. The economic financial markets around the world would shut down. The day after attack on September 11th, the markets fell, more than 15%. After something like this, we would expect the markets probably to collapse. In addition, there'd be a complete disruption of international trade. Ports around the world would close themselves out of fear that they might be the next target of a terrorist attack of this sort. Again, we saw this after September 11th when airline traffic was suspended for weeks. And I think the same thing would happen to shipping traffic after an attack of this sort. And the ripple effect throughout the global economy would probably be many trillions of dollars. An attack like this would also have a profound effect on the way we live subsequently. Civil rights, as we know them, I think would just go out the door. Faced with the fear that there might be another attack using nuclear weapons, I think all of us would tolerate a degree of intrusiveness into our lives that is just unacceptable or unimaginable today. But it would be the new norm. And so there's good reason to be concerned about a nuclear terrorist attack. But we have to understand this is the least of the dangers that we face. The next step up in level of concern is the possibility of a limited nuclear war between smaller nuclear weapon states. And the model which has attracted the most attention, the most concern, is the possibility of a war between India and Pakistan. These countries have gone to war three times since their independence from Britain in the late 40s. They've come close to war on two more occasions. There is daily fighting between India and Pakistan at the line of demarcation in Kashmir. And there have been a couple of incidents in the last 15 years when a terrorist attack directed against India and believed to have originated from groups based in Pakistan led to military mobilization on both sides. Now, the current situation in South Asia is that the Indian conventional forces are much, much stronger than much smaller Pakistan's army. And in response to that, the Pakistanis have developed a military doctrine that says that they will resort early on to the use of nuclear weapons, that if Indian conventional forces appear to be poised to score a major victory against Pakistan in a ground war, Pakistan will introduce the use of nuclear weapons and will do it fairly early on in the conflict. And so it's worth looking at what would happen if these countries use their nuclear arsenals. We have looked extensively at a scenario that is quite conservative. It assumes that India and Pakistan each use about 50 Hiroshima-sized bombs against the other country. Now, their current arsenals are about 120 weapons in the Pakistani arsenal and about 100 in the Indian arsenal. Many of them are 2 to 3 times larger than the Hiroshima bomb. So our scenario is very conservative in terms of the assumptions that it makes about how extensive the fighting would be. The consequences in South Asia are unbelievably catastrophic. 20 to 30 million people in our study are killed in the first week by the explosions, by the fire, by the local radiation. And again, to put this into perspective, using the World War II analogy, in all of World War II, worldwide, about 50 million people died. That was over 8 years, from the first Japanese incursion in Manchuria in 37 to the end of the war in 45. We'd see a similar number of deaths on the same order of magnitude occurring on the course of less than 1 week under the conditions of a war in South Asia. But these direct effects are only a small part of the story. The problem is that 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs detonated over cities produce about 6.5 million tons of soot that gets lofted into the upper atmosphere. And again, we've done a conservative study assuming that only 5 million tons of soot were generated. What that does is to block out sunlight across the planet, and it drops global temperatures on average 1.3 degrees centigrade. And it's a temperature drop that persists, according to the most recent studies that we've done, for up to 25 years. To put this in perspective, over the last 130 years, the global warming, which so much demands our attention, has accounted for a rise in temperature of about 7/10 of a degree. So this would be an anomaly twice as large occurring in 3 days. And in the interior regions of the major continents, the temperature drop would be much greater than the 1.3 degree global average. The concern here is that this would shorten the growing season, leading to later frosts in the spring, earlier frosts in the fall. The total amount of sunlight coming in would be decreased, which would cut down on the sunlight available for photosynthesis, and precipitation would decrease. When the temperature is cooler in the air, less water evaporates from the ocean to fall back as precipitation. And as a result of all of these factors, there would be a significant decline in food production worldwide. We have studied so far corn production here in the United States, the world's largest corn producer, and corn, rice, and wheat production in China, the world's largest producer of wheat and rice. And the effects are just catastrophic. Here in the United States, corn production goes down about 12% for a decade. In China, rice production goes down about 17% for a decade. Wheat production goes down 31% for a decade. Corn production goes down about 15%. These are decreases in food production, which are not something which the world can absorb at this point. World grain reserves at this moment in time amount to only about 80 days' worth of consumption. There's enough food stored to feed the planet for 80 days. And this would be a totally inadequate buffer in the event of a dramatic decrease in food production that lasted not for a single season, but for a decade or more. In addition, right now, at this moment, there are about 795 million people in the world who are malnourished. They get, on average, about 1,700 calories a day, which is just enough to maintain their body mass and let them do a little bit of work to grow food or to gather food. These people cannot tolerate a further decline in their food consumption. There are also about 300 million people who live in countries where the average nutrition today is quite good, but where much of the food is imported. And in the world after a limited nuclear war, with the kind of declines in food production that we will see, there will not be international commerce in food. Today's grain exporting countries will suspend their exports in order to be able to feed their own people. So these additional 300 million people living in countries like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Malaysia, most of the countries in the Middle East and North Africa, they too would face starvation. And finally, there are about 1 billion people in China who are relatively well-nourished today, who live in a country which grows most of its own food, but in a country which will see huge decreases in food production. And these billion people have not shared in the economic prosperity that the rest of the Chinese population has seen over the last 2 to 3 decades. We've concluded that these people also would be at great risk. And so worldwide, we're talking about something like 2 billion people who'd be at risk of starvation in the aftermath of this limited war taking place in one small localized region of the planet. The death of 2 billion people is an event unprecedented in human history. It's about 1/3 of the human race. We would have to expect that an event of this magnitude would lead to the end of modern civilization. There has never been a civilization in human history that has withstood a shock anywhere near this magnitude, and there's no reason to think that we would either. The international economic order that we all depend on would collapse, and we would lapse into something probably quite similar to the Dark Ages. And this is something that could happen to us while we're sitting here tonight. As I mentioned before, there's fighting every day between India and Pakistan. That's the second form of nuclear danger that we need to worry about. When I talked about the scenario that produces this nuclear famine, I talked about 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs. It's not just the Indian and Pakistani arsenals that can produce this effect. Each U.S. Trident submarine carries 96 warheads, not 100, but 96. Each of these is 10 to 50 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. That means that each Trident submarine can produce this same nuclear famine scenario. The United States has 14 of them. 8 of them are based right here across the water at Bangor. Each one of these submarines can cause this global catastrophe. We have 14. It's only 1/3 of our nuclear arsenal. We also have land-based missiles, and we have bombers that carry cruise missiles and gravity bombs. And the Russian arsenal has the same insane level of overkill capacity. So let us consider the greatest nuclear threat we face, the possibility of war between the United States and Russia. You know, for the last 25 years, we've been told we don't need to worry about this. The United States and Russia are not enemies anymore. There's no possibility of war. I was told by the Undersecretary of State for Disarmament as recently as 1.5 years ago that the United States simply does not consider the possibility of a war with Russia. Well, in the intervening 1.5 years, events in Syria, and especially events in Ukraine, have given the lie to the assurances that we have received since the end of the Cold War that we don't need to worry about this possibility. It is clear, I think, to most observers that military conflict between the United States and Russia is indeed possible, and that if that occurs, it is quite possible this will escalate to the use of nuclear weapons. There's been a frightening degree of nuclear saber rattling on both sides since the Ukraine crisis. President Putin has been particularly guilty of this, threatening to use nuclear weapons over the conflict there, warning that his country can reduce the United States to nuclear ashes. The United States, for its part, has conducted military exercises very close to the Russian border with forces that were advertised as being nuclear capable. It is a very frightening situation. So let's look at what would happen if those weapons get used. And I want to start by describing to you the effects of a modern-day attack on a single city. I think most of us are familiar with images of Hiroshima. Wiped flat, in the phrase of Dr. Junot, the Red Cross observer on the scene, by the bomb there. That was one single bomb, a small one by modern standards, about 15 kilotons, 15,000 tons of TNT equivalent. An attack today would not involve a single small bomb. It would involve many bombs, much larger. A city like Seattle would probably be attacked, given the number of strategic targets around the city, by 10 to 12, maybe 15 warheads, each of which in the range of 10 to 30 times more powerful than the bomb which destroyed Hiroshima. It's a little bit difficult for me to describe all of these bombs going off at once, so I want to use a model of a single explosion I'm going to use the model of a single 20 megaton explosion. The megatonnage here is slightly larger than would be actually be deployed against Seattle. But the destruction that I'm going to describe is actually less than we would see if 15 smaller bombs were distributed more evenly over the entire metropolitan area. But I think the model, it's adequate. It gives us an idea of what we're talking about. Within a thousandth of a second of the detonation of this bomb, a fireball would form, reaching out for 2 miles in every direction, 4 miles across. Within this area, the temperature would rise to 20 million degrees Fahrenheit, which is hotter than the surface of the sun. And everything would be vaporized. The buildings, the trees, the people, the upper level of the Earth itself would simply disappear. To a distance of 4 miles in every direction, the explosion would generate winds greater than 600 miles per hour and blast pressures greater than 25 pounds per square inch. Mechanical forces of this magnitude can destroy anything that human beings can build. To a distance of 6 miles in every direction, the heat would be so intense that automobiles would melt. And to a distance of 16 miles in every direction, the heat would still be so intense that everything flammable would burn. Buildings, cloth, wood, plastic, heating oil, gasoline, it would all ignite. Hundreds of thousands of fires, which over the next half hour would coalesce into a giant firestorm, 32 miles across, covering over 800 square miles. Within this entire area, the temperature would rise to 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit. All of the oxygen would be consumed, and every living thing would die. In the case of Seattle, we're talking about some 3 million people. In the case of a larger city like New York, the death toll would be 15 million people in a half an hour. And if this attack were part of a general war between the United States and Russia, the same level of destruction would be visited on every major city in both countries. And if NATO were drawn into the conflict, most of the great cities of Europe and Canada as well. A study which we published in 2002 showed that if only 300 warheads in the Russian arsenal got through to urban targets in the United States, something between 75 and 100 million people would die in the first half hour. In addition, the entire economic infrastructure of the country would be destroyed. Everything that we depend on, you know, we require an intact society to meet our needs. We don't grow our own food. We're not hunter-gatherers. And that intact infrastructure would simply vanish. There'd be no banking system. There'd be no internet. There'd be no electricity grid. There'd be no public health system. There'd be no food distribution system, no fuel distribution system. And in the months following this attack, it is probable that the vast majority of the American and Russian population would die from starvation, from exposure the subsequent winter, from radiation poisoning, from epidemic disease. Several hundred million people dead as the direct effects of this war. But again, as was the case with the scenario in South Asia, it's the climate effects that are really catastrophic. The war in South Asia puts about 6.5 million tons of soot into the upper atmosphere. A war between the United States and Russia, using just the weapons that will still be available to both countries when the New START Treaty is completely implemented in 2017. That war puts 150 million tons into the upper atmosphere, and it drops temperatures across the planet not 1.3 degrees centigrade, but 8 degrees centigrade. In the interior regions of North America and Eurasia, the temperatures drop 25 to 30 degrees centigrade. There have not been temperatures on this planet that cold since the coldest point in the last ice age, about 18,000 years ago. In the northern hemisphere, there would be at least 2 and probably 3 years without a single day free of frost. That means the temperature would go below freezing for at least some point of every day. And that means that the ecosystems which have evolved in the northern hemisphere would collapse because there'd be no spring, no summer, no ability for the plants to grow, for the trees to leaf out. Vast numbers of species would become extinct. Food production in the northern hemisphere would stop completely. The vast majority of the human race would starve to death, and it is possible that we would become extinct as a species. Now, this is a danger which we face every day. This is not just some scenario I've cooked up to ruin your evening. Even if we don't stumble into a war in Ukraine or in Syria, there is the ever-present possibility that there will be a war by accident. We know of at least five occasions since 1979 when either Moscow or Washington prepared to launch nuclear war in the mistaken belief that it itself was already under attack by the other side. The most recent of these took place that we know about in 1995, a full 5 years after the end of the Cold War. And on that occasion, the Norwegian government launched a missile to study the Northern Lights. They informed people in Moscow that this was taking place. Somebody in Moscow made a mistake and didn't pass the information on to Russian military radar. And when this four-stage rocket was picked up by Russian radar screens, it was misinterpreted as four warheads tracking towards Moscow and interpreted to be the first wave of a decapitating NATO strike against Russia. For the only time that we know about during the nuclear weapons era, the console, it's called the nuclear football, the console that the Soviet leadership carries at all times to respond to nuclear attack was activated. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. Boris Yeltsin was wakened up, and he was given a range of options on how to deal with the situation. They went from doing nothing and waiting things out to launching a full-scale nuclear attack against the United States, which at that point, back in 1995, would have involved about 4,000 warheads. Yeltsin should have launched World War III that day, according to existing Russian nuclear doctrine. Both Russia and the United States, then and now, operate under a doctrine called launch on warning, which holds that if you believe that you are subject to an incoming nuclear attack, you launch your own weapons before they're destroyed on the ground. We don't know what happened in the Kremlin that morning. Yeltsin, as you may recall, was a very sick man. He had heart problems, he was on steroids at times, and he also was an alcoholic who was incapacitated by his drinking for days at a time. It is literally possible that he was simply too drunk to make a decision that morning, and that's why we're here today. All that we know is that the Russian leadership, decided that morning to wait and see what happened. And after a few minutes, it was clear that these blips on the radar screen were not heading towards Moscow. And so the danger passed. January 25th, 1995, was a perfectly normal, good day. There was no crisis any place in the world that should have led to fighting between the United States and Russia, let alone to World War III. It was at a time that is much safer than the present moment. India and Pakistan had not tested their nuclear weapons yet. North Korea had not developed its nuclear weapons yet. September 11th hadn't taken place. The United States had not launched these terrible destabilizing wars in the Middle East. Conditions between the United States and Russia were dramatically better than they are today. And yet we came within minutes of launching nuclear war. And the conditions in terms of the technical systems which existed at that time, which allowed this near disaster, have not changed in any significant way since then. The same kind of accident on a computer could take place today. The difference is that given the increased level of tension between the United States and Russia, the chances are even greater that whichever side thought it was under attack would in fact launch a counterattack rather than sitting back and waiting. And in addition to this potential threat, we are now told by military leaders that there's another dimension to the computer problem, which is that terrorists could potentially hack into command and control computers and cause the launch of a nuclear missile in either the Russian or the U.S. arsenal, thereby almost certainly triggering a nuclear war. So this is a real and present danger, something which should be occupying our attention all the time. But it's important to understand that while this is the future that will be if we don't take action, it is not the future that must be. Nuclear weapons are not a force of nature. They're not an act of God. We have built these with our own hands, and we know how to take them apart. We've dismantled over 50,000 nuclear warheads since the height of the Cold War. We know how to do this. The only thing that's lacking is the political will. And fortunately, on that ground, there is some very hopeful news over the last few years. A movement has started led by the non-nuclear weapon states, to make the nuclear weapon states honor their responsibilities and negotiate the abolition of their weapons. It's a movement which I think is inspired a great deal by the physicians' movement and by the Red Cross in particular. In 2010, Jakob Kellenberger, then president of the Red Cross, gave a very important speech in Geneva to the diplomatic corps in which he indicated that while the Red Cross had always opposed nuclear weapons, it was now going to make their abolition a key focus of its work internationally. And the next year, 2011, when the Red Cross movement held its biannual meeting, there was a unanimous vote by every single Red Cross, Red Crescent Society in the world to call for the abolition of nuclear weapons and to begin a worldwide educational campaign about what they referred to as the humanitarian impact of nuclear war, what we doctors have called the medical consequences of nuclear war for the last three decades. Unfortunately, the American Red Cross has chosen not to be involved in this campaign. But in many countries around the world, the Red Cross is doing extraordinarily effective work educating people about how dangerous the situation is. Their work, in turn, inspired the non-nuclear weapon states, many of them, to take up this issue. And over the last several years, there have been a series of extraordinary governmental conferences focused on the humanitarian impact of nuclear war. The first was in Oslo in March of 2013. It brought together 120 countries. It was actively boycotted by the United States and the other four members of the UN Security Council, the five permanent members who are all the major nuclear powers, US, Russia, China, Britain, and France. Despite that boycott, perhaps in part because of that boycott, which underlined the urgency of non-nuclear weapon states providing leadership, the conference was a tremendous success and led to a follow-up meeting a year later in Nayarit, Mexico, at which over 130 countries attended and again spent several days examining what would happen if these weapons are actually used and what therefore needs to be done. The final meeting, shown on the slide, took place in Vienna in December of 2014. 158 countries attended this time, more than three quarters of the countries in the world. And this time the United States and Great Britain did attend, although they mainly played a spoiler role at the meeting. Despite their efforts, the meeting ended with an inspiring call by the Austrian government to close the gap in international law, which does not prohibit, does not ban the possession of nuclear weapons. All other indiscriminate weapons are banned under international law: chemical weapons, biological weapons, cluster bombs, landmines. They're all defined as being too inhumane, too indiscriminate in their effect to be tolerated. And yet nuclear weapons, the most dangerous weapons of all, are not explicitly banned. And so the Austrians said, we need to close this gap in international law and ban these weapons as a way of putting pressure on the nuclear weapon states to actually eliminate their arsenals. So far, this pledge, it's been called the Humanitarian Pledge, has been endorsed by over 140 countries. And at a vote at the UN General Assembly last fall, an open-ended working group was established to meet in Geneva to figure out how to, in fact, close the legal gap. The working group had its first meeting last month. Its second and most important substantive meeting will take place the first 2 weeks of May. Again, the United States is boycotting this event. But the 100-plus countries who are there are engaging in a serious conversation about what steps should take place next. And what is almost certain to emerge is a call for a new treaty which bans nuclear weapons and defines their possession as being illegal and brands the countries which continue to hold on to these weapons as rogue states, states that exist in violation of international law. There has not been a movement of this magnitude in the international community since the Cold War, and it is terribly important that we do whatever we can to support this initiative. Physicians for Social Responsibility and our global federation, IPPNW, have in the last 4 or 5 years created a global network, an umbrella group called the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which now involves over 450 NGO organizations in 95 countries across the planet. This network is led, interestingly, mainly by young people. Some of the ICANN leaders strategizing at the last meeting in at the UN. And it has had an enormous impact. It has been responsible for bringing many countries into the fold, getting many countries to endorse the pledge and to attend the meeting in Geneva. And it is, I think, an enormously positive and hopeful development. Now, on the flip side, on the negative side, is the continued intransigence of the United States and the other nuclear weapon states. Far from conceding the need to get rid of these weapons, all nine of the nuclear weapon states are currently engaged in active plans to modernize their nuclear arsenals. In the case of the United States, it is estimated that we will be spending, if we don't change the policy, we will be spending $1 trillion over the next 30 years to rebuild every single component of our nuclear arsenal, the submarines, the land-based missiles, the strategic bombers, and the weapons that they carry. This modernization plan is quite simply utterly incompatible with our treaty obligation to negotiate the abolition of our nuclear arsenal. And that is the great debate that needs to take place in this country. Are we going to modernize our arsenals at a cost of $1 trillion and pledge ourselves to continue relying on nuclear weapons in some way? Or are we going to choose the opposite path and work towards their abolition? It is a great disappointment that in this presidential election year, this debate is not taking place. It's part of our job to make sure that it does. I think we have to understand the enormity of the moment that we're in right now. It is truly a turning point. On the one hand, we have the most important disarmament initiative in a generation. On the other hand, we have plans to utterly defeat the aims of that movement by building a new nuclear arsenal. And it is a very stark choice that we face. And depending on the choice that we take, I think all else will follow. We have acted as though we can continue to maintain nuclear arsenals and have the world that we know continue. I would argue that simply isn't possible. We have been spectacularly lucky over the last 70 years that there has not been a nuclear war. And we have to recognize that. We are here today because we've been lucky. Reliance on continued good luck is simply not an acceptable policy for the future. We have to understand that if these weapons continue to exist, it is only a matter of time until they're used, and that if they're used, they're going to destroy everything that we hold precious. I think there are three reasons why we have not acted more decisively to get rid of these weapons, and let me just go through them very quickly. First, there is the general disbelief that this can actually happen. None of us really in our hearts believe that nuclear war can take place. We look at the world we live in every day, and we just can't imagine it being destroyed in the way that it will. But if we look around the history of the last 100 years, we see many, many examples of communities who thought that their existence couldn't be threatened, that were utterly destroyed by war. And we're no different. And we have to understand that, and we have to figure out how to convince the rest of our citizens and our leaders that, in fact, this is what's going to happen if we don't take action. Secondly, I think we don't begin to understand how bad the use of nuclear weapons would be. There's a whole extensive, literature and discography and filmography of apocalyptic stories and tales. And we've all seen them, and we all kind of have some idea of how horrible the future might look. But we don't really get it. We still sort of imagine that somehow it won't be quite that horrible. And so the information that I was presenting earlier, I think, is terribly important to get out. People need to understand just how bad these weapons are, just how complete the destruction will be. And third, we have to deal with the fact that for many people, there is still the notion that somehow or other, nuclear weapons protect us, that they make us more secure. I think it's easy to understand where this false idea comes from. Throughout much of human history, stronger weapons did tend to make us safer. If you're walking down a street and some person who you think is potentially an enemy is coming towards you with a big stick, if you have an even bigger stick, you're a little bit safer. The trouble is that with nuclear weapons, that logic just doesn't apply anymore. These are not weapons which make us secure. The use of our own nuclear weapons will destroy us. They are suicide bombs. And our thinking hasn't caught up with that. We still view them as potential instruments of our safety and security. And we have to get beyond that. And again, I think the key to that goes back to the second point I was making a minute ago. It goes back to the need for to fully understand what's going to happen if these weapons are used. There are leaders in nuclear weapon states who truly believe that they can use their nuclear arsenal and achieve some desirable outcome, and don't understand that if they use their nuclear weapons, they will be relegating their own country to destruction. So we need to deal with these three obstacles that stand in the way, and we need to create a movement, as we had back in the 1980s, that puts pressure on our leaders, and we need to talk directly to the leadership and ask them to do what they're supposed to do, provide leadership on this issue, because they're not at this point. Are we going to be successful? I can't promise that we will. It's not at all clear to me that we're going to survive this crisis. What I can say is if we don't try, nuclear war is going to be our fate. And what I can also say is that we have every reason to believe that if we work very hard, we can change things, because we've done it once before. In the 1980s, we were marching towards nuclear war, and we stopped that, and we saved the world. And we can and must do that again. When I talk to college audiences and high school audiences, I always invoke the Lord of the Ring, because everybody is pretty familiar with this story at this point. I think it's instructive. Nuclear weapons are the closest we've ever come on this planet to building a ring of power. And the desperate struggle to rid our planet of these weapons is every bit as heroic, every bit as grand, and every bit as dangerous as the struggle to rid Middle-earth of the Ring of Power. The only real difference is that the Fellowship of the Ring involved just a handful of people and elves and dwarves. Our fellowship really requires the involvement of all of us. No one of us can do this job by ourselves, but each one of us needs to do that part of the job which is ours to do. And that's the challenge before all of us. When I speak to audiences, I always feel a little bit of guilt, because by telling people who may not have known about this stuff before, by telling them about this, I put a real burden on their shoulders. And I've done that to you all tonight, if you weren't previously aware of this information. Once you know about the danger we face, you have a responsibility to take action. If you see somebody fall down on the street, you can't just walk over them. You have to help pick them up. If you know that your planet is in danger, you have to take action about this. And that's a great burden. And it's a burden that's not going to go away until we get rid of these weapons. But I also think that this responsibility is a great gift. Every one of us wants to have a worthwhile life. We want to do something good with our life. And we've been given the opportunity to save the world, which is a very good thing to do. So I think the challenge for all of us is to take on this burden, to do what we can to eliminate these weapons, to build the movement that will succeed, and at the end of our lives to be able to look back and say, in honesty, we helped to save the world. Thanks very much. And the last slide is one which I meant to put up as I was closing. This is what it's all about. The millions of children around the world can't save the world. They depend on us to do it.
That's it for this podcast extra from Speakers Forum. Dr. Ira Helfand spoke at Town Hall Seattle on March 20th. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum. Thank you.